Holly Cotton here, and you guys know I love, love, love a feel-good story. And I also am in love with people that are trying to be the change. And I met this gentleman at an event that I was hosting, and I loved his story. As soon as he started talking and everyone was talking so highly of him, I was like, okay, I got to hear his story in depth. He was also a keynote speaker at the event, so I cannot wait to hear his story today. I have Mr. Anthony Graves, who is an author, an exoneree turned criminal justice advocate. He's done a lot of stuff. Again, his story is very inspiring. He has a whole bunch of stuff that he's doing to prevent that from happening to other people, being a social justice and criminal justice advocate now. So, welcome, Anthony.
Wow, thank you. Thank you so much for the intro.
Yes. So before we go into it, because I know I've actually had a few people that are kind of similar to your story that have been exonerated. And I want to define what exonerated is, because a lot of people don't, they get the two confused where you're just released on parole or probation or whatever. And exonerated is completely different, because to be exonerated means that they said, you did not commit this crime. We're sorry. Here's $5. Good luck in life. Or something.
Pretty much how
Yeah,
it go.
exactly. So, can you give us your story and kind of just go into whatever details you want to share about how you were wrongly convicted and then how much time you served, and then we'll go later into how you got out and stuff, but I just want to go back to the actual conviction, because that's always something people don't, they think that the criminal justice system is going to save them. Oh, if I didn't do it, then I'm good. I'm good. But that's not the case. Right.
No,
So
no, it's
so
not.
tell us your story.
I take you back to 1992. A horrible crime had taken place in this small town, Somerville, Texas. An entire family was murdered. They were shot, stabbed, bludgeoned to death. Gasoline was poured all over their bodies, and the house was burned down. It was, I think, six people in the house. Four were children under the age of 10. One was a teenage daughter that was 16, and then the grandmother, who was, I think, 45 years old. So imagine in a small town with less than 3,000 people, a horrible crime like this takes place. Everyone is in outrage. So much so that the mayor had come out the next day and said that whoever had done this case didn't even deserve a trial. They should be caught and hanged, right? And that's kind of the way they pursued the case, because a week later they had the funeral. And at this funeral, a young man showed up with gauze around his face and his hands as though he's been in a fire and been burned. He eventually became a person of interest to the Texas Rangers that were already there at the funeral. After the funeral, the Texas Ranger approached this young man, who, by the way, name was Robert Carter, and asked if they could speak with him. He agreed, and so they followed him home. And when they got to his house, they put him in their vehicle and they took him to the DPS office, where they began to interrogate this young man for a period of 14 hours, right? At this point, nobody knows what he had said and all of this here. But at the end of the interrogation, they turn around and charge this man with capital murder. But he had been saying, no, they had been telling him that they know that he hadn't done this crime by himself, and they just wanted the name of someone. And if he could just give them the name of the person who actually done the crime with him, they would let him go. They just wanted the other person. So according to Mr. Carter, at this time, when they had took him to the DPS, he thought he had seen four young black men in a Jeep coming off the freeway onto the feeder. And so in that Jeep, he thought he had seen Anthony Graves. So when they go to interrogating this young man and ask him to give him a name of someone who could have done the crime with him, he called Anthony Graves' name because he thought he had seen me in the Jeep. His thinking, according to him, was that they would now go and find out that Mr. Graves didn't have nothing to do with it, but they would have also have let him go by then, right? And but that's not the way our system worked, okay? Because once he admitted that he had done a crime and said that Anthony Graves was involved with him, they turned around and charged him with capital murder and arrested him and put him in jail, right? So the next day, the next morning, there was a knock on my door. But this was my neighbor, Mike. And he had come to tell me that the police was looking for me. And I'm thinking, the police looking for me? For what? Right? He said, I don't know, man, but they asked if that's your vehicle out there. I'm like, okay. But I'm thinking, if the police looking for me, do I have a ticket out? Because I'm trying to think, why would the police be looking for me? So I said, okay, Mike. And I thought, well, if the police was looking for me, then they have gone by my auntie's house because I go there every day. So I decided to call my auntie and ask her, had the police been down there? And I called my auntie and Mike just told me that the police is looking for me. Have they been by there? She said, no, why would the police be looking for you? I said, I don't know, but that's what Mike said. She said, well, call the police station and find out. So I said, all right. And then I hung up and I thought better of it. I said, well, then if the police is looking for me, then I'll go downstairs, go outside and try to find the police, right? Because I want to know, why is the police looking for me? Now, this is the part of my story that I tell all my listeners. Who, if you don't remember anything else that I say in narrating my story, I want you to remember this part because this is the most important part. Don't ever go look for the police, okay? Don't do that. Let them find you. That is their job. Do not go look for the police. That is lesson 101. Don't look for the police. Because when I went out and I found the police, right, police pulls up. I stop. He gets out of his vehicle, and he asks me my name. I tell him my name, and he noticed that I'm not nervous or anything, so he asked me for some ID. I give him my driver's license. And then he started to tell me that, hey, I've been told to come pick you up and take you to the police station because I also want to ask you some questions. I said, well, can you tell me why? Because I wanted to let my mom know. And he said, no, but when you get down there, the officer will tell you. So by this time, my neighbor walks out who had knocked on my door. And I'm telling Mike, hey, Mike, this officer said I have to go to the police station with him, but my mother's on her way home. Could you just let her know? Tell her I should be right back home, right? Now, because in my mind, I have no idea why they're arresting me, but I know I haven't done anything wrong, so I'm coming right back home. Well, that took me 6,640 days and 2 execution dates before I was brought back home. Because, see, when I got down to the jailhouse, my worst nightmare awaited me, right? They asked me to take out everything in my pocket and have a seat in the booking room, which I complied, you know. And I'm sitting in this booking room after I've done all this, and I'm watching police officers walking in and out of the booking room. But nobody's saying anything to me. And so now I'm starting to ask, because it's a Sunday and I'm ready to go, right? I don't need to be in no police station. So I'm starting to ask the police officer, hey, man, can somebody tell me why I'm here? And it was like, well, the officer's on their way. They'll tell you when they get here. So about 20, 30 minutes went by, and then there were 4 Texas Rangers that walks into the booking room with a magistrate. And they asked me to stand up, and I did. And the magistrate started reading me my rights. You know, you have a right to remain silent and everything. And I'm trying to think, where is this going? All of this behind a traffic ticket that I don't even remember, right? And then at the end of it, she said, you've been charged with capital murder. Whoa, hold on. And this was my response. We didn't never see the video till after I got out, but this was my response. And if anyone would have seen the video, they would have knew this man knew absolutely nothing about what they were speaking on. So I was like, whoa, wait, me? Capital murder? You sure? I mean, I've never even shot a gun in my life, right? This is my reaction. And they would say, well, would you like to talk to us? Oh, of course I would like to talk to you. I'm innocent. I go back there and talk to them. And they listen to me. I'm everything but the child of God. I'm this, I'm that. But I'm not going to lie on myself. So I am steady trying to tell them that they got it wrong. And I'll be willing to cooperate. You know, whatever they want me to do, I'll be willing to do because I'm innocent. So they was like, okay, would you be willing to? No, I said, I'll be willing to take a lot of
tests. I was just about to ask you about the polygraph.
Anything. Mm-hmm. And so they was like, well, would you be willing to take the polygraph? I said, man, I'll take anything because I have nothing to hide. They said, okay, well, we'll set up a polygraph for you to take, right? And so in the meantime, they're going to put me in this holding cell. So I got to go into this holding cell while they set up a polygraph test down in Houston, Texas, which is like an hour and a half away from where I'm at, which is Brenham, Texas. So I go into the holding cell, and they keep me in there for 4 or 5 hours, right? It's freezing cold, but that's okay. I just want them to get this right. Finally, they say, hey, well, we're ready to take you for the polygraph. They get me, they shackle me, they take me, put me in a patrol car, and they drive 95, 100 miles an hour down the highway to the DPS office here in Houston. This is why we're going to take the polygraph.
And how old are you right now, Anthony? Just so people have...
At this age, I'm only 26 years old. I'm just 26. And so when we get to the DPS office and they take me in there, they introduce me to the polygraph operator. Now, this is a black man, right? So I've been with all these white Texas Rangers, and I just like speaking the truth. I've been with all these Texas Rangers, except there was one black Texas Ranger that was originally there, but he left. But I'm with all these white people, and now they said, we're going to let the black guy give you the polygraph test, right? Because we want you feeling comfortable. Okay, fine, no problem. So me and the black guy, we started making small talk. He asked me about my children, because I had three kids at the time. And I'm asking him about his, and we're establishing a good rapport. So he said, are you ready to take the test? I said, yes, sir. Let's get it over with. So he hooks me up to the test, and he has me facing toward the door. But he's behind me taking the polygraph. And he asked me three questions. Is your name Anthony Graves? Yes, sir. Is Anthony Graves your name? Yes, sir. Did you have anything to do with the Davis murders? No, sir. Is Anthony Graves your name? Yes, sir. And those are the three questions he asked me. And so finally, afterward, I hear him ripping up paper. I don't know. I'm not a polygraph operator, so I don't know how to read it, but I hear him ripping up paper. And so he said, well, it's over with. And I said to him, I said, whoo, man, glad, good, so I can go home. He said, well, not so fast, sir. I said, what? He said, well, you didn't pass the test. Now, so what, did I lie by my name? Did I lie when I said I wasn't there? I know I told you the truth, and now you're telling me that I failed the lie detector test. That's when I knew these people were not trying to find the truth in this case. They were trying to put a case on me. And now they wanted me to believe that I lied about a polygraph so that I could confess to a case that I did not do. But I was built differently. I'm not going to lie on myself. I don't care who you are. Right. And so
did they ever show you the results of the polygraph? What was he ripping up? Did you ever figure out what he was ripping up the results?
Never showed us the results. As a matter of fact, down the line, when we petitioned for the results, they could not find them. Me and my attorneys have never seen the results that they said I failed a polygraph on, but they could not produce the results for the court because polygraphs are not admissible in court, so they didn't have to come up with it, right? It's just a he say, she say thing. Well, we kind of figured out what was going on at that point, right? They were trying to get me to confess to a crime I did not commit. So after they did the polygraph, and he told me that, that's when the Texas Rangers run into the office, into the room where I was, and they start playing good cop, bad cop on me. They grabbed me, took my hand, twisted up my back like they was going to break my arm, and rushed me out the room while another one came and like he's going to save me from the other bad cop. Mm-hmm. Takes me away from the bad cop. Now he wants me to come and talk to him because he wants to help me. By this time, I'm crying. I'm not crying because I'm scared. I'm crying because, be honest with you, because I like to beat this dude ass and just put his hands on me for something I don't know nothing about. But I can't because they got guns and big hats, and here it is, I'm incarcerated.
And you're 26, too, and you've never been in no... It's old. Different when you grew up and you was a thug and you've been in the court system, man, since you were in high school.
Never done none of that.
Right, like you know what that means, but yeah, you were completely oblivious.
I was totally oblivious to the way this thing goes. And so after this, the officer sit me down and I'm crying. And he's trying to tell me, hey, just tell me what happened. I want to help you. This. And I'm started trying to tell him, man, I'm not going to lie on myself and I'm not going to lie on nobody else. I really, I'll do this the right way, right? And then so the other officer, he walks to me, walks over the chief ranger, and he stands in my face and he just looks at me. And he says to me, and I will never, ever forget these words. He said, Mr. Graves, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think you did this. But if you don't give me nothing to put on Carter, we're going to put this whole thing on you. And if you're actually innocent, then don't let no grass grow on your grave. And he looked at the officer and said, now get him out of here. So I looked at him, I said, so I got to go to jail for something I didn't do? He looked me in my face, he turned, and he walked off. At this point, they drove like 95 miles an hour back to this other small town in Burleson County where the case happened, and put me in jail. Put me in this small little dog kennel, right? And I had, by this time, I hadn't talked to my mom. And it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And I know my mom is worried. And so I started asking him, man, can I talk to my mother? And he said, well, okay, well, when we book you in, we'll let you call your mom. So they booked me in and I called my mom. It's like 3 o'clock that morning. And she's like, where are you? And I said, man, they got me somewhere in some jail up in Milam County. Talking about I'm supposed to have done a crime. I don't even know nothing about this. This is me talking to my mom. And she like, I know you don't know nothing about this because the lady that was murdered worked with my mother at a state school. They were best friends. And nobody, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so my mom was like, you don't even know her, right? And I'm like, well, can you just at least describe these people to me if I'm going to have to be in jail for them? Right? This is my mind. And she was like, don't worry about this. You don't even know them. And not that, whatever. I stayed in jail 2.5 years waiting on trial. I kept asking them to take me to trial, and they kept pushing it off. I had a high-paid attorney at first who they were afraid to even go up against, and at this time, they were talking about dropping the charges against me. But I couldn't pay this man $150,000, right? And because I couldn't pay this man $150,000, he got off my case. And when he got off my case, then that's when the rogue prosecutor decided to move forward. They went and got me a criminal defense attorney who hadn't been 3 years out of practice to be my lead attorney on the capital murder case. He's never even tried a capital murder case. Black man. So anyway, they put me in jail 2.5 years and I'm waiting trial. So finally, after 2.5 years, they decide we're going to go to trial. I'm pushing them. I want to go to trial. We want to change the venue so that I can get a fair trial, as they say. So they gave me a change of venue down to this place called Angleton, Texas. Little did I know that Angleton, Texas was where they took the last case and won on a man who had a mental ill issue. That was the only case they had took to Angleton. Little did I know Angleton had a history of racism, okay? The Ku Klux Klan, the dragon, the whatever it is, wizard, lived down there. Little did I know that I was being set up to be wrongfully convicted when they gave me this change of venue. So after 2.5 years, we had this change of venue, and we get down here to Angleton, Texas. And the whole notion of me being there was that they wanted me to get a fair trial. But about a week out from the trial, the prosecutor was down there on the 5 o'clock news every day talking about me being guilty. So he was tainting the jury pool. Mm-hmm. So by the time that the jury got there for voir dire, picking the jury, everybody said he must have done something or you wouldn't have had him here. Now, these are people we're going to pick 12 from. That's going to be the jury of my peers who've already said he must have done something. Otherwise, you wouldn't have him here. Now, this whole notion of innocence until proven guilty is hogwash. It's hogwash because you're taking 12 people off the streets who know nothing about the law and you're putting them in a jury box and you say make the most important decision in the room, but you don't know nothing about the law. Right.
And I've so heard people you've been getting say that too. They said that you're guilty. So the trial is to prove that you're innocent instead of the way that we think it is. We think the trial is they're trying to prove your guilt. But actually, the trial right. is to prove that you didn't do it. That's the whole purpose of it, is to prove your innocence. OK, I'm ready. Well, come on. Go. OK. I'm ready. All right. Well, OK, so in Angleton, you got 12 jurors they've been fed through the news that you're guilty. And now you go to trial.
So, yes. So we're in trial now. And we got the 12 jurors seated. And my attorney, who is a black man, tells me, because now you have to understand, on my jury, it's 11 white and one black man that's been picked. So my attorney comes to me, he say, well, I'm finna go back into the jury room and see who are they gonna pick for the foreman. And immediately I just blurted out, man, it's gonna be the black man. He said, why you say that? I said, man, it's gonna be the black man.
Call the token.
He said, well, let me go out and see. Yeah, so he goes into the room. 5 minutes later, he comes back. He said, how did you know it was gonna be the black man? I said, man, these folks are finna convict me before they even hear this case. I said, and then they're going to put the black man as the face of the jury, man. I said, be honest with me. How many times have you heard 11 white people ready and willing to follow one black man unless they know where he's going? I said, they know what they're doing. They're making him. He can't be the only person to vote not guilty. So they've already got a guilty vote from him because he's going to prove to them that he can do his job. I seen this movie before. All right, this is history, man, and it's playing out. I say, think about Scott, Dre Scott, when he was on stand, and they said that he couldn't claim property because he was property himself. This is how they're treating me, man. And he was like, well, let's just hope that's not the case. Say we go into a trial, and lo and behold, 3 days of testimony. 3 days of testimony. They go back in that back room, and in 9 hours of deliberation, they come out and found an innocent man guilty of murder with no evidence. No evidence. They found a man guilty of murder. And so after that point, you have part two of your trial, which is the punishment phase.
Sentencing phase.
So now they're already convicting me of capital murder, right? And now it comes to the sentencing part. And so my attorney is telling me, I want to bring your family on to testify about your character. And I'm telling him, no, I don't want my family involved. And he's saying, I want your family involved because the first thing I want to do is save your life. Mm-hmm. I believe in your innocence, but we need to save your life because the state will execute you, right? And I'm telling him, no, I don't want to do that. But reluctantly, I agree, right? Because my family wanted to do it. So I listened to my mom get up there and talk about her son, her oldest son, being the glue of the family. I listened to my sister get up there and talk about how her oldest brother helps her out with her children while she goes to night school. I babysit for her, right? She was becoming a nurse. And then I listened to my own son get up there and talk about, you know, my son had sickle cell anemia. And every time he would have a crisis, I would always be at the hospital with him. And I'm listening to my son sit up there and try to tell 12 people who don't know his dad that he needs his dad, that his dad is his strength, right? After my son got down from that witness stand, the 12 people went back into the jury room and an hour and a half sentenced me to death with no evidence. My life had little value to them. They sentenced me to death with no evidence. So after this, I'm exhausted. I'm really exhausted because I really thought that the system would work. I'm innocent. I don't even know the people. I wasn't even in the same town a crime happening. So how can you just convict me? That's absolutely no evidence that puts me in this place. But when the jury, my attorney said he was going to go back there and talk to the jury and see what was the reason for them coming up with this guilty verdict, the first thing they told my attorney is that he showed no remorse. While we was in the courtroom, Mr. Gray showed no remorse. Mind you, that my attorney advised to me in the courtroom, no matter what you hear, I don't want you to respond to it because you don't know how the jury is going to take it. Don't shake your head. Don't do nothing.
Right.
Because you don't know how the jury is going to take that. Well, because I didn't do anything, they say they convicted me because I didn't show any remorse. And because my attorneys were not good and they felt that if they convicted me, then I would get new attorneys. There was no evidence that they used to convict me. This is what the jury.
And how do they want you to show remorse for a crime that you didn't commit? Like, remorse means I did something and now I'm sorry. It's not that you're not sorry that the people died, but I'm not gonna be remorseful. I didn't do it. I wasn't there. Yeah. What happened to the other guy, the one that said that you were there? What happened to him?
They convicted him and they executed him.
Oh.
Right, so he was executed by the state in 2000. But here's the thing: what we didn't know during this time is so when during my trial, they had already convicted this young man, but they brought him back to testify against me, right, during my trial. But what we didn't know is he was refusing to testify against me because he was telling them that I was innocent and that he did not want to testify against the innocent man. So they said, okay. Then if you say he's innocent, then take a polygraph test. He said, okay, this is the morning of my trial. We don't know this. They got him in the back. So they say they're going to set up a polygraph for him. He agreed to take a polygraph. When he took the polygraph, they never asked him one question about Anthony Gray. They asked him question about his wife's involvement. And then they turned around and told him that he showed deception in the polygraph. And that there was no statute of limitation on going back after his wife because I didn't tell you, but they had arrested his wife and charged her and had her in jail for 2 months and then let her go on a PR bond because they knew she had nothing to do with it, but let her go and told her to keep going because there was no statute of limitation on the case. So at this point, the guy, now they tell him he's showing deception in the polygraph. So he decided at this point he needed to allow Mr. Graves to protect his wife. So he said, I did the, how did he say it? I did the rock, somebody rocking a hard, he was in the rock and a hard place, and he did the less of the two evils. He lied on Mr. Graves. He said, so at that point, they know that he's lying on Mr. Graves, but they're okay with that. So he came up and during the trial and testified that I was involved in this case with him, but he never could look me in my face. He pointed like that when they asked him to point me out. But then immediately after that, he went back to claiming my innocence and said that he had been telling them this whole time that I was innocent. But they never told us this. So we had a hearing on it. They had a deposition. And when Mr. Carter was on death row, they brought the state attorneys. They brought Mr. Carter out, and they had a deposition down there. And Mr. Carter, in front of the state and everyone, told that prosecutor, I told you Mr. Graves was innocent. You told me that's not what you wanted to hear. He said, oh, Robert, you know, were you honest when you were saying that? He said, yes. You remember, you came to my cell and I told you, Mr. Sylvester, I do not want to testify against Mr. Gray because he's innocent. You said that's not what I wanted to hear. He said, I told you over and over this man was innocent. So he testified before his execution in front of the state that he had been telling the state that I was innocent, and they never told nobody this. So when Mr. Carter was getting executed, his dying declaration on his execution table in 2000, he had his family there and the victim's family was there. And he could have said any and everything he wanted to say. This was his moment. What he chose to say shocked the whole world. He chose to use that time to reiterate once again, Mr. Graves is innocent. That man is innocent. I lied on Mr. Graves. He knows nothing about this case. My wife knows nothing about this case. Those were his dying words. Is he was still trying to right a wrong. And they knew this. But it took me 8 more years to come home. And along with 2 more execution dates. By this time, now they're trying to murder me. Because this young man has been telling the world that I'm innocent. But they don't want to do the right thing. So what they've done, they end up setting me 2 execution dates back to back, trying to murder me. And hadn't even went through my appeal process yet. Now they was hoping that the attorneys would make a mistake and they could murder me and nobody would know anything about this case. But God is good, all right? And I'm not the person that just lay down like that. I was writing any and everybody while I was back there asking them to please help me save my life. I don't care who you were. If you were 6 years old, 8 years old, 28, 58. All I was asking you to do is please help me save my life. And so because of all of that, I started an organization called Join Hands for Justice Behind Bars. And it started overseas in Europe. I reached out to people in France, Norway, Sweden, Germany, China, all over the world, Togo, Africa. Please help me save my life. And from that, I started this nonprofit from behind bars called Join Hands for Justice. And everybody from across the globe started coming together in my name, kind of echoing from the shores of Europe of my innocence. And it got here. And then when it got here, a freelance investigator heard about it, came down and interviewed me, found out about my case, was shocked, reached out to the Innocent Project and said, this is a case I think y'all really need to get involved in. It took about another 8 to 10 years, but I eventually came home because they found out what they already knew was that I was actually innocent. And so because of that, I've dedicated my life to advocating for a better criminal justice system so that this does not happen to anyone else. I have 3 boys out here, and I definitely don't want to visit them in prison for a crime they did not commit. So I'm dedicated to advocating for a better criminal justice system today because of what I went through.
So we're going to go into that. But what I want to also do, Anthony, is because I want to share your story. So I want people to be able to hear your story and then realize how insane and intense and how those moments were for you. So I know you gave us the how you got arrested and then the conviction and all of that. And I also know how you gave us the free advice. Don't go looking for the police. Don't go. If the police, if someone says the police are looking for you, do not go look for them. I love that advice. Thank you. But what I want to do is I want to also show you as a person. And I want you to go back to that moment of where you're sitting in the court. Because I know you said that you had the mindset of, holy crap, they're really going to convict me. Like, they're really going to say I'm guilty of this. Like, you thought it was. But it's to actually hear those words and the process that comes after that is completely different. It's kind of like, you know, you on the scale and you're like, I know I'm a good 150. I know I'm, you know, but I've been eating bad. I'm probably about 180, but you don't really think it, you know, you're hoping when you step on it, the scale says you're 135 or something, you know, you don't want to believe it. So it's kind of like that. It's like, you were envisioning that they were going to find you guilty. There were so many signs that were saying that you're, that they were going to find you guilty with the jury and everything else. But I know you still had hope in your heart that they were not going to say those words. So can you go back and tell us exactly when the foreman stood up, made the announcement, how it happened and what happened next? And you know, cause that's the other thing too. People don't see, I just see stuff on TV, on the movies or whatever, where now they put you in handcuffs and you're going, but we don't know what it is to live in that moment. So can you give us, I know it's hard to go back and relive it, but I want whoever's listening to hear that, cause that's what happens in these cases. People forget that you're a real person. They almost dehumanize you in that moment because they see you as a criminal. You did something, so lock them up, throw away the key. So can you tell us about that when they said that you were guilty and then what happens after that?
So we were sitting at the table and, you know, it's 12. I'm gonna just be honest. I see white people who are finna make a decision about my life, right? On something that I know absolutely nothing about, right? In a small Texas town, right? Where racism exists. And it's, I mean, the Grand Wizard live in this town, okay? So when they ask for the verdict and I seen the jury, the foreman stands up and the bailiff gets the note from the foreman and hands it to the judge. The judge starts, he looks at the note, and then he tells everybody in the audience, okay, when I read the verdict, I don't want no responses from no one, right? Everybody has to be quiet when we read the verdict, such and such. Okay. So he says, Mr. Gray, and that's my attorney, would you please rise? So I stand up. But I know what's happening. I already know what's happening. 11 white people that are my jury, one black who's the foreman who has to follow the 11 whites. I understand what's happening. So when I stand up and he started reading the charge, and then it says that I've been found guilty of capital murder. All my energy just drained out of my body. I was, even though I knew this, I understood the history, still I was hoping that they did the right thing. I was still hoping that I would be wrong and they would actually do the right thing. But as history is a good teacher, I knew I had the right answer immediately when I seen the setup. And so because I was so drained emotionally, physically, spiritually, I just sat down. And so the prosecutor, them thought I didn't understand. But I understood. I was just drained because I've been fighting for 2.5 years just trying to prove that I'm innocent. And now here you are, you done convicted me. Give me a guilty conviction. And now what do I do with this? And so I'm just drained. So the prosecutor jumps up and said, Judge, I don't think he understands what's going on. But I understood. You just lied on me and now you finna add me to your tree of killing black people. Okay. So I'm just trying to process this. How did I go from being a model citizen, being a person that everybody liked, to being sentenced for a crime, found guilty for some killing black people, black children? Are you serious? This what you gonna put on me? I never even shot a gun in my life. I never harmed anyone. I'm not a criminal. And this is what you're going to put on me? So I'm just drained. I'm emotionally just drained. And so when he said that he didn't think that I understood, the judge told my attorney, counselor, would you approach the bench with your client? So me and my attorney had to go and stand in front of the judge while the judge explained to me that the state has just convicted me, right? Okay, all right. So after that, I'm listening. He said, do you understand? I just did this, shrugged my shoulders, but I'm not there. I'm not there. You're not going to convince me that I did something that I know I'm not. I didn't do. You're not going to convince me to play along. I'm sorry. I'm not that person. So after that, they ended up, I look behind me and I see my family, my mom, my boy, and my siblings, them, right? And they're trying to hold it together for me, and everybody's like, it's going to be all right, it's going to be all right. But, you know, yeah, it's going to be all right, but damn, I'm broken right now because I really want to go home. I really want to be with my family. I really want to be with my son. And I got to go. I've been convicted. And so now you got to have the second part, and that's when they're telling me that they wanted me to put my family up there, and I'm telling them no. And my family goes up there and testify. And then my son and them all testify in the second part. And afterwards, they go back, like I said, an hour and a half, find me guilty. So when they asked me again to stand in front of the judge so he can tell me that they sentenced me to death, and I'm looking at this judge, and he's telling me that the state has sentenced me to death as though he's going to live forever. And I'm saying to myself, man, do not get caught up in wordplay. Do not get caught up in wordplay. All right? There's nothing that's going to happen to you without God granting it. Okay? It has to be the will of God. And remember that. Always remember that. So can't nothing happen to you without the will of God. So stay there. Stay in that space. That saved my life. Because there was nothing that they could do to me that I felt could touch me unless God granted them permission. And I knew then, okay, this is bigger than me. I need to pay attention to what's going on in my life. And so for the years that I was down there witnessing so many men get executed, I witnessed over 400 some people get executed around me. I was growing in the knowledge of what was really happening in our criminal justice system so that I could get out here and share it with the rest of the world. So I felt like at the end of the day, I went through all that I had to go through so that I can get back out here and advocate for a better criminal justice system that does not target its people.
So when you got convicted and then you were sentenced to death, did they take you off to prison and were you on death row immediately? Like, is that what happened, or is there a transitional place, or once you get sentenced to death, they're just like, he's going on death row?
Yeah, well, that was sort of a transition because, you know, when I got the voir dire in Angleton. So once I was convicted, they had to take me back to the regular jail where the case happened, and that was on a Friday. So they took me back to the local jail on that Friday. At Monday morning, they transported me off to death row. So it's like 2 days, and I'm headed to death row, and I'm not a criminal, and all I know is this is where the worst of the worst supposed to be, and I'm supposed to go live with all these people, and I don't know nothing. And I'm scared, right? But I'm not gonna lie on myself. That's nobody right. That walks this earth that's gonna make me lie, right? And that's just what it's gonna be. I've already made my peace with God that this is bigger than me. So God, if you just keep me and sustain me through this, whatever your will is, I do. Whatever it is you want me to do, I do. And so this is why I've dedicated my life to what I'm doing, because I made that promise with my God. You just see me through this. Because I've seen so many people losing their minds before they were even executed. Mm-hmm. right? And I'm just asking
That's
God.
what I was going to say too, Anthony. I was going to say, it's like, even if you don't believe in God, even if you have another version of like, you know, Jehovah, Allah, whatever, you got to go, you got to dig deep for spirituality.
Yes.
Either something is going to have to keep you going, or you're just going to go off into, you know, a web of depression. Now, let me ask you this. So as someone who was falsely convicted, or excuse me, as someone who was wrongly convicted of a crime and were sentenced to death, do you feel that the death penalty is unjust? Are you against the death penalty? Or since being on death row and seeing people that are actually who committed these crimes and who are actually like owning that they did those crimes, and you're like, oh my God, that's heinous. Right. You deserve to die. Do you feel that being wrongly convicted sort of made you feel differently about like death row and the death penalty?
Well, you know, I've gone through a lot of emotions with this. I've thought about this extensively. How do I really feel about the death penalty, right? Because I know there are some people that I met down there that I would never want to see out here, never want to see living around my children, my family, my mother, right? But the same people that I'm talking to you about have issues, mental illness issues. And we say kill them? So the people that I'm saying I would never want to see out here are the people that I also say need real mental help. But we're saying, don't give them that, just kill them. And so for that reason and others, I don't believe in the death penalty. Not in the perfect world, maybe. But I was down there, and I know that even though I was innocent, I was a lottery pick. There were other innocent people down there was not coming home. They were getting executed. I was a lottery pick. So because I know this firsthand, I cannot support a death penalty that I know was executing innocent people. I know this for a fact. No reading no books, no watching television. I live down there. I listen to those guys who were getting executed, who I had to convince to walk, keep their head up and have some dignity about themselves while the state was murdering them. And they were claiming they're innocent. I witnessed this. So I cannot believe in something that I know is infallible. I mean, fallible. I know as man put this together, man made many mistakes and it's carrying out that way. We are executing innocent people and we're calling it justice. And we have people supporting it because we're selling them fear and saying that this is what we have to do to keep you safe, that this person is no longer redeemable. I met men back there who we call the worst of the worst will give you the shirt off their back. They no longer had mitigating circumstances in their life. They were no longer being abused by their parents, being put in closets and suffocating. They were no longer having guns, being on drugs. They were all those things were removed. And what you had was a person that was remorseful, a person that wished they just had another chance. Not all of them. Some people had given up on life and was okay by being executed because they didn't think they had a life outside of the bars anyway. So they was fine with being executed. But for the most part, I met men down there who laughed, who cried, who loved their family, who talked about their mothers, and who was trying to face death head on because they knew that that was going to be the end result behind those bars. I met those men, and I did not walk away saying, man, all of them need to be executed. I walked away feeling like half of them was my friends. Some of them was family members to me. Some of them, what they did for me, no one else out here would have ever done in that situation that I was in. So, no, I don't believe in the death penalty because I think that the death penalty says that we're giving up on people too quick. Who are us to judge? Who are you to tell the world that I need to die? And you getting it wrong. What happens to you now? How can we support something that is fallible as the death penalty? How can we do this? Because at some point, your child, your loved one, your neighbor is going to be faced with this. And you're going to have to decide at that point, do you still believe in the death penalty? It can't be for other people. Because I tell people all the time, if you believe in the death penalty, that's perfectly fine with me. But you better believe in it when they come and arrest your son and your daughter and talk about he done something. That's the same sentence that they're going to carry out on your child. You better be willing to believe in it then. Because it's not fair for you to believe in it for everybody else's child and not your own. Remember, whatever you wish to be a part of the fabric of our criminal justice system, you're not exempt from it, nor is your family. So think very carefully when you answer that question, do I believe in the death penalty? Because when you say yes, remember, you're saying yes to your mother, you're saying yes to your brother, you're saying yes to your family members, if they so get in that situation. Remember that.
Dang it, Anthony. How am I supposed to make some clips for social media? You done made us catch the Holy Ghost like 15 times. You got me about to shed a tear. Yeah, I was supposed to make a clip, a 3-minute clip from all of this. You know what? I can't. Okay. Man, that was deep. Oh my goodness. And I have a big heart because I cry for everything. So you got me about to cry. So, all right. Now we done caught the Holy Ghost. Anthony done preached to us. We done got it. He done told you about yourself. You better be ready. You better be ready. I love it. I love it, Anthony. Okay, so tell us about to close everything up. Tell us about, like you said, now you have this mission that you started in prison behind bars. And tell us what the mission is and how, like, what are we doing? How can I support it just being someone on the outside?
Oh, wow, the mission is revolutionary. So since I've been out, when I was back there, I've seen that a lot of guys didn't have support, right? Families would have just left them for years. They haven't heard from anyone. And that makes them want to give up. They were dropping their appeals. They just wanted to be executed because they had no one in their life, right? It wasn't even the case that was the hardest thing. It was the fact that there was no one in their life, right, to be that was supporting. Mm-hmm. So when I came home, you know, I started doing the Innocent Project, Innocent Clinic. I got the next exoneree out, which was after Dwayne Brown. But I felt like I needed to do more, right? People were coming out of prison and were not given any second chances. They would call them second chances, but they were not given second chances. They were given minimal jobs. You know, you can get a job as a janitor, but you couldn't get a job as a substitute teacher, right? So I said, well, you know, when I got out, attorneys started calling me, asking me to help them with their client. And I started visiting their clients. And when I would go visit their client, it was just totally different. There was an instant communication there. Connection there. Trust was already there, right? And so I was helping them navigate a unique skill set coming out of prison to go back and mentor men and women incarcerated as well as their family. And we can get to the best outcome. Man, we can reduce recidivism. We can save time. All of these good things. So I created what is called the Peer Navigator Project. That is training formerly incarcerated individuals how to work alongside criminal defense attorneys to go back into the jails and mentor their clients as well as their family members in hopes of getting to the best outcome in the courtroom. So I created the Peer Navigator Project, and I'm working along with criminal defense attorneys to do this work, and it's been amazing. It has been transformative, game-changing. Matter of fact, some of the attorneys come to me now and say, hey, man, since I found out about this Peer Navigator Project, I cannot see myself working without one. So it's a game changer, right? I'm in talks with a lot of different organizations who want Peer Navigators to come on and mentor their clients. A lot of attorneys want Peer Navigators to come on and mentor their clients. So it's a groundbreaking, transformative, revolutionary experience that I think is going to really shape the courts and shape the criminal justice system and save us a lot of time.
Now, do you do anything, because I know this is my last question, but do you do anything with like the youth or like the juvenile criminal system, or is it specifically for, like, do you have a specific population of people that you're reaching out? Who's your targeted audience with your program?
All men, women, boys, and girls that are incarcerated.
Okay.
That's it. That's my targeted audience and their families, you know, because we want to help them get through the worst parts of their life.
I love that. I love that. Okay. So Anthony is also an author. He made us catch the Holy Ghost 15 times. So we ain't even get to his book, his podcast, all of his other stuff. So we're going to have to get him to come back. But the stuff that you did share was definitely a different angle. And I love that you were able to give us that inside perspective of it. Because for me, hearing that story, putting it to putting a story with a person and actually not something you see on the movie, but just allowing us to see a personal side of that is like the priceless. So thank you for telling us about that. So how can people, again, get your book, support you? Do you have a website? If there is someone that is incarcerated, how can they reach out to you? Or, you know, a family member that might be saying, oh, well, you know, what can he do for my son who's locked up and going through the same thing as him?
Yes, we have a website, peernavigatorproject.org, and you can reach out to me at agpeernavproject@gmail.com. If you want to just reach out to me personally, that again is agpeernavproject@gmail.com. But if you just want to go check out our website and see the amazing work we're doing, just go to peernavigatorsproject.org. And hopefully, you know, if you're formerly incarcerated, if you have a loved one that's incarcerated and you want to learn more about how you can support them, send us an email, reach out to us, join our class. Let's come together and let's make a system better for all of us. So, yeah, peernavigatorproject.org is game changing.
And can people volunteer or help, or how can we support you? Because I don't know anyone. Thank God, I don't know anyone, or none of my family members are incarcerated at right now. Fingers crossed. So, but say there's people like me, but they're inspired by your story and they want to help, they want to donate, they want to participate, be a part of this movement. What can we do from the outside that don't even have anyone that's incarcerated, but we just want to be part of the organization?
Well, the first thing you can do, and this is so important, and I know you probably hear this all the time, but this is so very important. This is expensive work. Donating, that is more than half the work, funding, resources. Or if you have any organization, or if you are part of organization and you want to extend your services to someone that is formerly incarcerated, reach out to us and let us put you in our database so that we can know where you are and what you do, so we can send people your way when they need help. Those are things that you can do. But donating, signing up for volunteer services to just help people kind of reacclimating themselves back into society. If you want to be part of that, if you have resources, if you have organizations that gear toward helping people that are trying to get back into society, man, please reach out to us. Because, you know, what I come to realize is that a lot of people do this work in silos. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of people they fall through the cracks because they don't know what these silos are. But if we can all come together, if we can all come together, we can help these people and we can fulfill the missions that we promised ourselves we would do. So, yeah, reach out to me, Peer Navigator Project, agpeernav@gmail.com. Let's come together and make this thing work. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. And that's another thing, too, that I always try to look like when I hear people's story like yours, Anthony, or I see people that are doing things to be the change. A lot of times I try, and it's hard for me, too, as someone that's in the media, because I try to make sure I'm able to personalize it without exploiting someone's story. But people don't realize how important it is to share stories like yours. It's not exploiting it. It's letting people know that this is a thing. This is something that's going on. These are real people that are being affected. And a lot of times people don't know how they can even help, or they don't know that there is a need for help until we highlight stories like yourself. So yes, thank you for being that vessel, that sharing the story and sharing this mission. And you guys, scroll down to the podcast notes. I will have all of Anthony's information that he just dropped, the email, the website information, and all of that stuff in the podcast notes. So just scroll down to the notes and you can find clickable links. Yes, sir.
And I just want you to know, I'm also have launched my podcast called Beyond Bars. Okay. So I would love for you guys to go tune in. That would be a lot of great storytellings from people who've been formerly incarcerated, who's come out here and have success to share with us. So we want to hear about the success of people who coming out and changing their lives. So that's what Beyond Bars podcast would be about. Those successful stories of people who are coming from incarceration. So.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, if you got anybody that has a great story, you know, send them my way, because your girl always.
I would definitely send them your way.
You know, because I'm about collaboration. There ain't no competition. Ma'am. We collaborate.
We're going to collaborate. When they get through with me, I'm sending them to you.
There you go. I love it. I love it. Okay. That is Anthony Graves, you guys. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you so much, Holly.
And, okay.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you so much. And hopefully I can join your podcast again one day and just kind of keep people up on what we're doing.